This is Audible.
Listening Library presents Where the Red Fern Grows by Wilson Rawls. Read for you by Anthony Heald.
When I left my office that beautiful spring day, I had no idea what was in store for me. To begin with, everything was too perfect for anything unusual to happen. It was one of those days when a man feels good. Feels like speaking to his neighbor, is glad to live in a country like ours and proud of his government. You know what I mean, one of those rare days when everything is right and nothing is wrong. I was walking along whistling when I heard the dog fight. At first I paid no attention to it. After all, it wasn't anything to get excited about, just another dog fight in a residential section. As the sound of the fight grew nearer, I could tell there were quite a few dogs mixed up in it. They boiled out of an alley, turned, and headed straight toward me. Not wanting to get bitten or run over, I moved over to the edge of the sidewalk. I could see that all the dogs were fighting one. About 25 feet from me, they caught him, and down he went. I felt sorry for the unfortunate one. I knew if something wasn't done quickly, the sanitation department would have to pick up a dead dog. I was trying to make up my mind to help when I got a surprise. Up out of that snarling, growling, slashing mass reared an old red-bone hound. For a second I saw him. I caught my breath. I couldn't believe what I had seen. Twisting and slashing, he fought his way through the pack and backed up under the low branches of a hedge. Growling and snarling, they formed a half-moon circle around him. A big bird dog, bolder than the others, darted in. The hedge shook as he tangled with the hound. He came out so fast he fell over backwards. I saw that his right ear was split wide open. It was too much for him, and he took off down the street squalling like a scalded cat. A big, ugly cur tried his luck. He didn't get off so easy. He came out with his left shoulder laid open to the bone. He sat down on his rear and let the world know that he had been hurt. By this time, my fighting blood was boiling. It's hard for a man to stand and watch an old hound fight against such odds. Especially if that man has memories in his heart like I had in mine. I had seen the time when an old hound like that had given his life so that I might live. Taking off my coat, I waded in. My yelling and scolding didn't have much effect, but the swinging coat did. The dog scattered and left. Down on my knees, I peered back under the hedge. The hound was still mad. He growled at me and showed his teeth. I knew it wasn't his nature to fight a man. In a soft voice, I started talking to him. "Come on, boy," I said. "It's all right. I'm your friend. Come on now." The fighting fire slowly left his eyes. He bowed his head, and his long red tail started thumping the ground. I kept coaxing. On his stomach, an inch at a time, he came to me and laid his head in my hand. I almost cried at what I saw. His coat was dirty and mud-caked. His skin was stretched drum-tight over his bony frame. The knotty joints of his hips and shoulders stood out a good 3 inches from his body. I could tell he was starved. I couldn't figure it out. He didn't belong in town. He was far out of place with the boxers, poodles, bird dogs, and other breeds of town dogs. He belonged in the country. He was a hunting hound. I raised one of his paws, and there I read the story. The pads were worn down, slick as the rind on an apple. I knew he had come a long way, and no doubt had a long way to go. Around his neck was a crude collar. On closer inspection, I saw it had been made from a piece of checkline leather. 2 holes had been punched in each end, and the ends were laced together with baling wire. As I turned the collar with my finger, I saw something else. There, scratched deep in the tough leather, was the name Buddy. I guessed that the crude, scribbly letters had probably been written by a little boy. It's strange indeed how memories can lie dormant in a man's mind for so many years, yet those memories can be awakened and brought forth fresh and new just by something you've seen or something you've heard or the sight of an old familiar face. What I saw in the warm gray eyes of the friendly old hound brought back wonderful memories. To show my gratitude, I took hold of his collar and said, "Come on, boy, let's go home and get something to eat." He seemed to understand that he had found a friend. He came willingly. I gave him a bath and rubbed all the soreness from his muscles. He drank quarts of warm milk and ate all the meat I had in the house. I hurried down to the store and bought more. He ate until he was satisfied. He slept all that night and most of the next day. Late in the afternoon, he grew restless. I told him I understood, and as soon as it was dark, he could be on his way. I figured he had a much better chance if he left town at night. That evening, little after sundown, I opened the back gate. He walked out, stopped, turned around, and looked at me. He thanked me by wagging his tail. With tears in my eyes, I said, "You're more than welcome, old fellow. In fact, you could have stayed here as long as you wanted to." He whined and licked my hand. I was wondering which way he would go. With one final whimper, he turned and headed east. I couldn't help smiling as I watched him trot down the alley. I noticed the way his hind quarters shifted over to the right, never in line with the front, yet always in perfect rhythm. His long ears flopped up and down, keeping time with the jogging motion of his body. Yes, they were all there, the unmistakable marks of a hunting hound. Where the alley emptied into the street, he stopped and looked back. I waved my hand. As I watched him disappear in the twilight shadows, I whispered these words, "Goodbye, old fellow. Good luck, and good hunting." I didn't have to let him go. I could have kept him in my backyard. But to pen up a dog like that is a sin. It would have broken his heart. The will to live would have slowly left his body. I had no idea where he had come from or where he was going. Perhaps it wasn't too far. Or maybe it was a long, long way. I tried to make myself believe that his home was in the Ozark Mountains, somewhere in Missouri or Oklahoma. It wasn't impossible, even though it was a long way from the Snake River Valley in Idaho. I figured something drastic must have happened in his life, as it is very unusual for a hound to be traveling all alone. Perhaps he had been stolen, or maybe he had been sold for some much-needed money. Whatever it was that had interrupted his life, he was trying to straighten it out. He was going home to the master he loved, and with the help of God he would make it. To him it made no difference how long the road or how rough or rocky. His old red feet would keep jogging along, on and on, mile after mile. There would be no crying or giving up. When his feet grew tired and weary, he would curl up in the weeds and rest. Water from a rain puddle or a mountain stream would quench his thirst and cool his hot, dry throat. Food found along the highway or the offerings from a friendly hand would ease the pangs of hunger. Through the rains, the snows, or the desert heat, he would jog along, never looking back. Some morning he would be found curled up on the front porch. The long journey would be over. He would be home. There would be a lot of tail wagging and a few whimpering cries. His warm, moist tongue would caress the hand of his master. All would be forgiven. Once again, the lights would shine in his dog's world. His heart would be happy. After my friend had disappeared in the darkness, I stood and stared at the empty alley. A strange feeling came over me. At first, I thought I was lonely or sad, but I realized that wasn't it at all. The feeling was a wonderful one. Although the old hound had no way of knowing it, he had stirred memories, and what priceless treasures they were. Memories of my boyhood days, an old KC baking powder can, and two little red hounds. Memories of a wonderful love, unselfish devotion, and death in its saddest form. As I turned to enter my yard, I started to lock the gate, and then I thought, no, I'll leave it open. He might come back. I was about halfway to the house when a cool breeze drifted down from the rugged Tetons. It had a bite in it, and goose pimples jumped out on my skin. I stopped at the woodshed and picked up several sticks of wood. I didn't turn on any lights on entering the house. The dark, quiet atmosphere was a perfect setting for the mood I was in. I built a fire in the fireplace and pulled up my favorite rocker. As I sat there in the silence, the fire grew larger. It crackled and popped. Firelight shadows began to shimmer and dance around the room. The warm, comfortable heat felt good. I struck a match to light my pipe. As I did, two beautiful cups gleamed from the mantel. I held the match up so I could get a better look. There they were, sitting side by side. One was large, with long upright handles that stood out like wings on a mourning dove. The highly polished surface gleamed and glistened with a golden sheen. The other was smaller and made of silver. It was neat and trim and sparkled like a white star in the heavens. I got up and took them down. There was a story in those cups, a story that went back more than a half century. As I caressed the smooth surfaces, my mind drifted back through the years, back to my boyhood days. How wonderful the memories were. Piece by piece, the story unfolded. I suppose there's a time in practically every young boy's life when he's affected by that wonderful disease of puppy love. I don't mean the kind a boy has for the pretty little girl that lives down the road. I mean the real kind. The kind that has four small feet and a wiggly tail and sharp little teeth that can gnaw on a boy's finger. The kind a boy can romp and play with, even eat and sleep with. I was 10 years old when I first became infected with this terrible disease. I'm sure no boy in the world had it worse than I did. It's not easy for a young boy to want a dog and not be able to have one. It starts gnawing on his heart and gets all mixed up in his dreams. It gets worse and worse until finally it becomes almost unbearable. If my dog wanting had been that of an ordinary boy, I'm sure my mother and father would have gotten me a puppy. But my wants were different. I didn't want just one dog. I wanted two. And not just any kind of dog. They had to be a special kind and a special breed. I had to have some dogs. I went to my father and had a talk with him. He scratched his head and thought it over. "Well, Billy," he said, "I heard that old man Hatfield's collies is going to have pups. I'm sure I can get one of them for you." He may as well have poured cold water on me. "Papa," I said, "I don't want an old collie dog. I want hounds, coon hounds, and I want two of them." I could tell by the look on his face that he wanted to help me but couldn't. He said, "Billy, those kind of dogs cost money, and that's something we don't have right now. Maybe someday when we can afford it you can have them, but not right now." I didn't give up. After my talk with Papa, I went to Mama. I fared no better there. Right off, she said I was too young to be hunting with hounds. Besides, a hunter needed a gun, and that was one thing I couldn't have, not until I was 21 anyway. I couldn't understand it. There I was, sitting right in the middle of the finest hunting country in the world, and I didn't even have a dog. Our home was in a beautiful valley far back in the rugged Ozarks. The country was new and sparsely settled. The land we lived on was Cherokee land, allotted to my mother because of the Cherokee blood that flowed in her veins. It lay in a strip from the foothills of the mountains to the banks of the Illinois River in northeastern Oklahoma. The land was rich, black, and fertile. Papa said it would grow hair on a cross-cut saw. He was the first man to stick the cold steel point of a turning plow into the virgin soil. Mama had picked the spot for our log house. It nestled at the edge of the foothills in the mouth of a small canyon and was surrounded by a grove of huge red oaks. Behind our house, one could see miles and miles of the mighty Ozarks. In the spring, the aromatic scent of wildflowers, red buds, pawpaws, and dogwoods drifting on the wind currents spread over the valley and around our home. Below our fields, twisting and winding, ran the clear blue waters of the Illinois River. The banks were cool and shady. The rich bottom land near the river was studded with tall sycamores, birches, and box elders. To a 10-year-old country boy, it was the most beautiful place in the whole wide world, and I took advantage of it all. I roamed the hills and the river bottoms. I knew every game trail in the thick canebrakes and every animal track that was pressed in the mud along the riverbanks. The ones that fascinated me the most were the baby-like tracks of a river coon. I'd lie for hours examining them. Before leaving, I'd take a switch and sweep them all away. These I called my trail looks. The next day I'd hurry back, and sure enough, 9 times out of 10, there in the clean-swept ground, I would again find the tracks of a ring-tailed coon. I knew he had passed over the trail during the night. I could close my eyes and almost see him, humped up and waddling along, fishing under the banks with his delicate little paws for crawfish, frogs, and minnows. I was a hunter from the time I could walk. I caught lizards on the rail fences, rats in the corn crib, and frogs in the little creek that ran through the fields. I was a young Daniel Boone. As the days passed, the dog-wanting disease grew worse. I began to see dogs in my sleep. I went back to my father and mother. It was the same old story. Good hounds cost money, and they just didn't have it. My dog-wanting became so bad, I began to lose weight, and my food didn't taste good anymore. Mama noticed this, and she had a talk with Papa. "You're going to have to do something," she said. "I never saw a boy grieve like that. It's not right. Not right at all." "I know," said Papa, "and I feel just as badly as you do, but what can I do? You know we don't have that kind of money."
"I don't care," said Mama. "You've got to do something. I can't stand to see him cry like that."
Besides, he's getting to be a problem. I can't get my work done. He follows me around all day long, begging for hounds.
I offered to get him a dog, said Papa, but he doesn't want just any kind of dog. He wants hounds, and they cost money. Do you know what the Parker boys paid for those two hounds they bought? $75. If I had that much money, I'd buy another mule. I sure do need one.
I had overheard this conversation from another room. At first it made me feel pretty good. At least I was getting to be a problem. Then I didn't feel so good. I knew my mother and father were poor and didn't have any money. I began to feel sorry for them and myself. After thinking it over, I figured out a way to help. Even though it was a great sacrifice, I told Papa I had decided I didn't want two hounds. One would be enough. I saw the hurt in his eyes. It made me feel like someone was squeezing water out of my heart. Papa set me on his lap, and we had a good talk. He told me how hard times were, and that it looked like a man couldn't get a fair price for anything he raised. Some of the farmers had quit farming and were cutting railroad ties so they could feed their families. If things didn't get better, that's what he'd have to do. He said he'd give anything if he could get some good hounds for me, but there didn't seem to be any way he could right then. I went off to bed with my heart all torn up in little pieces and cried myself to sleep. The next day, Papa had to go to the store. Late that evening, I saw him coming back. As fast as I could, I ran to meet him, expecting a sack of candy. Instead, he handed me three small steel traps. If Santa Claus himself had come down out of the mountains, reindeer and all, I would not have been more pleased. I jumped up and down and cried a whole bucket full of tears. I hugged him and told him what a wonderful papa he was. He showed me how to set them by mashing the spring down with my foot and how to work the trigger. I took them to bed with me that night. The next morning, I started trapping around the barn. The first thing I caught was Sammy, our house cat. If this didn't cause a commotion, I didn't intend to catch him. I was trying to catch a rat, but somehow he came nosing around and got in my trap. My sister started bawling and yelling for Mama. She came running, wanting to know what in the world was going on. None of us had to tell her. Sammy told her with his spitting and squalling. He was mad. He couldn't understand what that thing was that was biting his foot, and he was making an awful fuss about it. His tail was as big as a wet corn cob, and every hair on his small body was sticking straight up. He spit and yowled and dared anyone to get close to him. My sisters yelled their fool heads off all the time, saying, "Poor Sammy, poor Sammy." Mama shushed them up and told me to go get the forked stick from under the clothesline. I ran and got it. Mama was the best helper a boy ever had. She put the forked end over Sammy's neck and pinned him to the ground. It was bad enough for the trap to be biting his foot, but to have his neck pinned down that way was too much. He threw a fit. I never heard such a racket in all my life. It wasn't long until everything on the place was all spooked up. The chickens started cackling and flew way up on the hillside. Daisy, our milk cow, all but tore the barn lot up and refused to give any milk that night. Sloppy Ann, our hog, started running in circles, squealing and grunting. Sammy wiggled and twisted. He yowled and spit, but it didn't do him any good. Mama was good and stout. She held him down tight to the ground. I ran in and put my foot on the trap spring, mashed it down, and released his foot. With one loud squall, he scooted under the barn. After it was all over, Mama said, "I don't think you'll have any more trouble with that cat. I think he has learned his lesson." How wrong Mama was. Sammy was one of those nosy kind of cats. He would lie up in the red oak limbs and watch every move I made. I found some slick little trails out in our garden down under some tall hollyhocks. Thinking they were game trails, and not knowing they were Sammy's favorite hunting trails, I set my traps. Sammy couldn't understand what I was doing out there, messing around his hunting territory. He went to investigate. Wasn't long until I had him limping with all 4 feet. Every time Papa saw Sammy lying around in the warm sun with his feet wrapped up in turpentine rags, he would laugh until big tears rolled down his cheeks. Mama had another talk with Papa. She said he was going to have to say something to me, because if I caught that cat one more time, it would drive her out of her mind. Papa told me to be a little more careful where I set my traps. "Papa," I said, "I don't want to catch Sammy, but he's the craziest cat I ever saw. He sees everything I do and just has to go sniffing around." Papa looked over at Sammy. He was lying all sprawled out in the sunshine, with all four paws bandaged and sticking straight up. His long tail was swishing this way and that.
"You see, Papa," I said, "he's watching me right now, just waiting for me to set my traps."
Papa walked off toward the barn. I heard him laughing fit to kill. It finally got too tough for Sammy. He left home. Oh, he came in once in a while, all long and lean-looking. But he never was the same friendly cat anymore. He was nervous and wouldn't let anyone pet him. He would gobble down his milk and then scoot for the timber. Once I decided to make friends with him because I felt bad about catching him in my traps. I reached out my hand to rub his back. He swelled up like a sitting hen. His eyeballs got all green, and he growled way down deep. He spat at me and drew back his paw like he was going to knock my head off. I decided I'd better leave him alone. In no time at all, I cleaned out the rats, and then something bad happened. I caught one of Mama's prize hens. I got one of those young man peach tree switchings over that. Papa told me to go down in the cane breaks back of our fields and trap. This opened up all kinds of new wonders. I caught opossums, skunks, rabbits, and squirrels. Papa showed me how to skin my game. In neat little rows, I tacked the hides on the smokehouse wall. I'd stand for hours and admire my magnificent trophies. There was only one thing wrong. I didn't have a big coon skin to add to my collection. I couldn't trap old Mr. Ringtail. He was too smart for me. He'd steal the bait from the traps, spring the triggers, and sometimes even turn them over. Once I found a small stick standing upright in one of my traps. I showed it to Papa. He laughed and said the stick must have fallen from a tree. It made no difference what Papa said. I was firmly convinced that a smart old coon had deliberately poked that stick in my trap. The traps helped my dog wanting considerably, but like a new toy, the newness wore off, and I was right back where I started from. Only this time it was worse, much worse. I had been exposed to the feel of wildlife. I started pestering Mama again. She said, "Oh, no, not that again. I thought you'd be satisfied with the traps." "No, Billy, I don't want to hear any more about hounds." I knew Mama meant what she said. This broke my heart. I decided I'd leave home. I sneaked out a quart jar of peaches, some cold cornbread, and a few onions, and started up the hollow back of our house. I had it all figured out. I'd go away off to some big town, get 100 dogs, and bring them all back with me. I made it all right until I heard a timber wolf howl. This stopped my home leaving. When the hunting season opened that fall, something happened that was almost more than I could stand. I was lying in bed one night trying to figure out a way I could get some dogs when I heard the deep baying of a coon hound. I got up and opened my window. It came again. The deep voice rang loud and clear in the frosty night. Now and then I could hear the hunter whooping to him. The hound hunted all night. He quit when the roosters started crowing at daybreak. The hunter and the hound weren't the only ones awake that night. I stayed up and listened to them until the last tones of the hound's voice died away in the daylight hours. That morning I was determined to have some hounds. I went again to Mama. This time I tried bribery. I told her if she'd get me a hunting dog, I'd save the money I earned from my furs and buy her a new dress and a box full of pretty hats. That time I saw tears in her eyes. It made me feel all empty inside, and I cried a little, too. By the time she was through kissing me and talking to me, I was sure I didn't need any dogs at all. I couldn't stand to see Mama cry. The next night I heard the hound again. I tried to cover my head with a pillow to shut out the sound. It was no use. His voice seemed to bore its way through the pillow and ring in my ears. I had to get up and again go to the window. I'm sure if that coon hunter had known that he was slowly killing a 10-year-old boy, he would have put a muzzle on his hound. Sleep was out of the question. Even on nights when I couldn't hear the hound, I couldn't sleep. I was afraid if I did, he would come, and I would miss hearing him. By the time hunting season was over, I was a nervous wreck. My eyes were red and bloodshot. I had lost weight and was as thin as a beanpole. Mama checked me over. She looked at my tongue and turned back one of my eyelids. "If I didn't know better," she said, "I'd swear you weren't sleeping well. Are you?" "Why, Mama," I said, "I go to bed, don't I? What does a boy go to bed for if it isn't to sleep?" By the little wrinkles that bunched up on her forehead, I could tell that Mama wasn't satisfied. Papa came in during one of these inspections. Mama told him she was worried about my health.
"Oh," he said, "there's nothing wrong with him. It's just because he's been cooped up all winter. A boy needs sunshine and exercise. He's almost 11 now, and I'm going to let him help me in the fields this summer. That'll put the muscles back on him."
I thought this was wonderful. I'd finally grown up to be a man. I was going to help Papa with the farm. The dog-wanting disease never did leave me altogether. With the new work I was doing helping Papa, it just kind of burned itself down and left a big sore on my heart. Every time I'd see a coon track down in our fields or along the riverbanks, the old sore would get all festered up and start hurting again. Just when I'd given up all hope of ever owning a good hound, something wonderful happened. The good Lord figured I had hurt enough, and it was time to lend a helping hand. It all started one day while I was hoeing corn down in our field close to the river. Across the river, a party of fishermen had been camped for several days. I heard the old Maxwell car as it snorted and chugged its way out of the bottoms. I knew they were leaving. Throwing down my hoe, I ran down to the river and waded across at a place called the Shannon Ford. I hurried to the campground. It was always a pleasure to prowl where fishermen had camped. I usually could find things, a fish line or a forgotten fish pole. On one occasion, I found a beautiful knife stuck in the bark of a sycamore tree, forgotten by a careless fisherman. But on that day, I found the greatest of treasures, a sportsman's magazine discarded by the campers. It was a real treasure for a country boy. Because of that magazine, my entire life was changed. I sat down on an old sycamore log and started thumbing through the leaves. On the back pages of the magazine, I came to the for sale section. Dogs for sale. Every kind of dog. I read on and on. They had dogs I had never heard of, names I couldn't make out. Far down in the right-hand corner, I found an ad that took my breath away. In small letters, it read, "Registered Red Bone Coon Hound Pups, $25 each." The advertisement was from a kennel in Kentucky. I read it over and over. By the time I had memorized the ad, I was seeing dogs, hearing dogs, and even feeling them. The magazine was forgotten. I was lost in thought. The brain of an 11-year-old boy can dream some fantastic dreams. How wonderful it would be if I could have two of those pups. Every boy in the country but me had a good hound or two. But $50? How could I ever get $50? I knew I couldn't expect help from Mama and Papa. I remembered a passage from the Bible my mother had read to us. God helps those who help themselves. I thought of the words. I mulled them over in my mind. I decided I'd ask God to help me. There, on the banks of the Illinois River, in the cool shade of the tall white sycamores, I asked God to help me get two hound pups. It wasn't much of a prayer, but it did come right from the heart. When I left the campground of the fishermen, it was late. As I walked along, I could feel the hard bulge of the magazine jammed deep in the pocket of my overalls. The beautiful silence that follows the setting sun had settled over the river bottoms. The coolness of the rich black soil felt good to my bare feet. It was the time of day when all furried things come to life. A big swamp rabbit hopped out on the trail, sat on his haunches, stared at me, and then scampered away. A mother gray squirrel ran out on the limb of a bur oak tree. She barked a warning to the four furry balls behind her. They melted from sight in the thick green. A silent gray shadow drifted down from the top of a tall sycamore. There was a squeal and a beating of wings. I heard the tinkle of a bell in the distance ahead. I knew it was Daisy, our milk cow. I'd have to start her on the way home. I took the magazine from my pocket, and again I read the ad. Slowly, a plan began to form. I'd save the money. I could sell stuff to the fishermen. Crawfish, minnows, and fresh vegetables. In berry season, I could sell all the berries I could pick at my grandfather's store. I could trap in the winter. The more I planned, the more real it became. There was the way to get those pups. Save my money. I could almost feel the pups in my hands. I planned the little doghouse and where to put it. Collars I could make myself. Then the thought came, what could I name them? I tried name after name, voicing them out loud. None seemed to fit. Well, there would be plenty of time for names. Right now, there was something more important. $50. A fabulous sum, a fortune, far more money than I had ever seen. Somehow, some way, I was determined to have it. I had 23 cents, a dime I had earned running errands for my grandpa, and 13 cents a fisherman had given me for a can of worms. The next morning I went to the trash pile behind the barn. I was looking for a can, my bank. I picked up several, but they didn't seem to be what I wanted. Then I saw it, an old KC baking powder can. It was perfect, long and slender, with a good tight lid. I took it down to the creek and scrubbed it with sand until it was bright and new-looking. I dropped the 23 cents in the can. The coins looked so small, lying there on the shiny bottom, but to me it was a good start. With my finger I tried to measure how full it would be with $50 in it. Next I went to the barn and up in the loft. Far back over the hay and up under the eaves I hid my can. I had a start toward making my dreams come true. 23 cents. I had a good bank, safe from the rats and from the rain and snow. All through that summer I worked like a beaver. In the small creek that wormed its way down through our fields, I caught crawfish with my bare hands. I trapped minnows with an old screen wire trap I made myself, baited with yellow cornbread from my mother's kitchen. These were sold to the fishermen, along with fresh vegetables and roasting ears. I tore my way through the blackberry patches until my hands and feet were scratched raw and red from the thorns. I tramped the hills, seeking out the huckleberry bushes. My grandfather paid me 10 cents a bucket for my berries. Once Grandpa asked me what I did with the money I earned. I told him I was saving it to buy some hunting dogs. I asked him if he would order them for me when I had saved enough. He said he would. I asked him not to say anything to my father. He promised me he wouldn't. I'm sure Grandpa paid little attention to my plans. That winter I trapped harder than ever with the three little traps I owned. Grandpa sold my hides to fur buyers who came to his store all through the fur season. Prices were cheap, 15 cents for a large opossum hide, 25 for a good skunk hide. Little by little, the nickels and dimes added up. The old KC baking powder can grew heavy. I would heft its weight in the palm of my hand. With a straw, I'd measure from the lip of the can to the money. As the months went by, the straws grew shorter and shorter. The next summer, I followed the same routine. "Would you like to buy some crawfish or minnows? Maybe you'd like some fresh vegetables or roasting ears." The fishermen were wonderful, as true sportsmen are. They seemed to sense the urgency in my voice and always bought my wares. However many was the time, I'd find my vegetables left in the abandoned camp. There never was a set price. Anything they offered was good enough for me. A year passed. I was 12. I was over the halfway mark. I had $27.46. My spirits soared. I worked harder. Another year crawled slowly by. And then the great day came. The long, hard grind was over. I had it. My $50. I cried as I counted it over and over. As I set the can back in the shadowy eaves of the barn, it seemed to glow with a radiant whiteness I had never seen before. Perhaps it was all imagination, I don't know. Lying back in the soft hay, I folded my hands behind my head, closed my eyes, and let my mind wander back over the 2 long years. I thought of the fishermen, the blackberry patches, and the huckleberry hills. I thought of the prayer I had said when I asked God to help me get 2 hound pups. I knew he had surely helped, for he had given me the heart, courage, and determination. Early the next morning, with the can jammed deep in the pocket of my overalls, I flew to the store. As I trotted along, I whistled and sang. I felt as big as the tallest mountain in the Ozarks. Arriving at my destination, I saw 2 wagons were tied up at the hitching rack. I knew some farmers had come to the store, so I waited until they left. As I walked in, I saw my grandfather behind the counter. Tugging and pulling, I worked the can out of my pocket and dumped it out in front of him, and looked up. Grandpa was dumbfounded. He tried to say something, but it wouldn't come out. He looked at me, and he looked at the pile of coins. Finally, in a voice much louder than he ordinarily used, he asked, "Where did you get all this?" "I told you, Grandpa," I said. "I was saving my money so I could buy 2 hound pups, and I did. You said you would order them for me. I got the money, and now I want you to order them." Grandpa stared at me over his glasses, and then back at the money.
How long have you been saving this?
He asked. A long time, Grandpa, I said.
How long?
He asked. I told him, 2 years. His mouth flew open, and in a loud voice he said,
2 years!
I nodded my head. The way my grandfather stared at me made me uneasy. I was on needles and pins. Taking his eyes from me, he glanced back at the money. He saw the faded yellow piece of paper sticking out from the coins. He worked it out, asking as he did,
What's this?
I told him it was the ad, telling where to order my dogs. He read it, turned it over, and glanced at the other side. I saw the astonishment leave his eyes, and the friendly old grandfather look come back. I felt much better. Dropping the paper back on the money, he turned, picked up an old turkey feather duster, and started dusting where there was no dust. He kept glancing at me out of the corner of his eye as he walked slowly down to the other end of the store, dusting here and there. He put the duster down, came from behind the counter, and walked up to me. Laying a friendly old work-calloused hand on my head, he changed the conversation altogether, saying,
Son, you need a haircut.
I told him I didn't mind. I didn't like my hair short. Flies and mosquitoes bothered me. He glanced down at my bare feet and asked,
How come your feet are cut and scratched like that?
I told him it was pretty tough picking blackberries barefoot. He nodded his head. It was too much for my grandfather. He turned and walked away. I saw the glasses come off and the old red handkerchief come out. I heard the good excuse of blowing his nose. He stood for several seconds with his back toward me. And when he turned around, I noticed his eyes were moist. In a quavering voice, he said,
Well, son, it's your money. You worked for it, and you worked hard. You got it honestly, and you want some dogs. We gonna get those dogs. Be damned! Be damned!
That was as near as I ever came to hearing my grandfather curse, if you can call it cursing. He walked over and picked up the ad again, asking,
Is this 2 years old, too?
I nodded.
Well, he said, the first thing we have to do is write this outfit. There may not even be a place like this in Kentucky anymore. After all, a lot of things can happen in 2 years.
Seeing that I was worried, he said,
Now, you go on home. I'll write to these kennels, and I'll let you know when I get an answer. If we can't get the dogs there, we can get them someplace else. And I don't think, if I were you, I'd let my pa know anything about this right now. I happen to know he wants to buy that red mule from old man Potter.
I told him I wouldn't, and turned to leave the store. As I reached the door, my grandfather said in a loud voice,
Say, it's been a long time since you've had any candy, hasn't it?
I nodded my head. He asked,
How long?
I told him, A long time.
Well, he said, we have to do something about that.
Walking over behind the counter, he reached out and got a sack. I noticed it wasn't one of the nickel sacks, it was one of the quarter kind. My eyes never left my grandfather's hand. Time after time, it dipped in and out of the candy counter. Peppermint sticks, jawbreakers, whorehound, and gumdrops. The sack bulged. So did my eyes. Handing the sack to me, he said,
Here. First big coon you catch with those dogs, you can pay me back.
I told him I would. On my way home, with a jawbreaker in one side of my mouth and a piece of whorehound in the other, I skipped and hopped, making half an effort to try to whistle and sing, and couldn't for the candy. I had the finest grandpa in the world, and I was the happiest boy in the world. I wanted to share my happiness with my sisters, but decided not to say anything about ordering the pups. Arriving home, I dumped the sack of candy out on the bed. 6 little hands helped themselves. I was well repaid by the love and adoration I saw in the wide blue eyes of my 3 little sisters. Day after day, I flew to the store. Grandpa would shake his head. Then on a Monday, as I entered the store, I sensed a change in him. He was in high spirits, talking and laughing with half a dozen farmers. Every time I caught his eye, he would smile and wink at me. I thought the farmers would never leave, but finally the store was empty. Grandpa told me the letter had come. The kennels were still there, and they had dogs for sale. He said he had made the mail buggy wait while he made out the order. And another thing, the dog market had gone downhill. The price of dogs had dropped $5. He handed me a $10 bill.
Now there's still one stump in the way, he said. The mail buggy can't carry things like dogs, so they'll come as far as the depot at Tahlequah. But you'll get the notice here because I ordered them in your name.
I thanked my grandfather with all my heart and asked him how long I'd have to wait for the notice. He said,
I don't know, but shouldn't take more than a couple of weeks.
I asked how I was going to get my dogs out from Tahlequah.
Well, there's always someone going in, he said, and you can ride in with them.
That evening the silence of our supper was interrupted when I asked my father this question. Papa, how far is it to Kentucky?
I may as well have exploded a bomb. For an instant there was complete silence, and then my oldest sister giggled. The two little ones stared at me. With a half-hearted laugh, my father said,
Well, now, I don't know, but it's pretty good ways. What do you want to know for, thinking of taking a trip to Kentucky?
No, I said. I just wondered.
My youngest sister giggled and asked,
Can I go with you?
I glared at her.
Mama broke into the conversation.
I declare, what kind of a question is that? How far is it to Kentucky? I don't know what's gotten into that mind of yours lately. You go around like you were lost, and you're losing weight. You're as skinny as a rail, and look at that hair. Just last Sunday they had a haircutting over at Tom Rowland's place. But you couldn't go. You had to go prowling around the river in the woods.
I told Mama that I'd get a haircut next time they had a cutting, and I'd just heard some fellas talking about Kentucky up at the store and wondered how far away it was.
Much to my relief, the conversation was ended. The days dragged by. A week passed, and still no word about my dogs. Terrible thoughts ran through my mind. Maybe my dogs were lost. The train had a wreck. Someone stole my money. Or perhaps the mailman lost my order. Then at the end of the second week, the notice came. My grandfather told me that he had talked to Jim Hodges that day. He was going into town in about a week, and I could ride in with him to pick up my dogs. Again, I thanked my grandfather. I started for home. Walking along in deep thought, I decided it was time to tell my father the whole story. I fully intended to tell him that evening. I tried several times, but somehow I couldn't. I wasn't scared of him, for he never whipped me. He was always kind and gentle. But for some reason, I don't know why, I just couldn't tell him. That night, snuggled deep in the soft folds of a feather bed, I lay thinking. I had waited so long for my dogs, and I so desperately wanted to see them and hold them. I didn't want to wait a whole week. In a flash, I made up my mind. Very quietly, I got up and put on my clothes. I sneaked into the kitchen and got one of Mama's precious flour sacks. In it, I put 6 eggs, some leftover cornbread, a little salt, and a few matches. Next, I went to the smokehouse and cut off a piece of salt pork. I stopped at the barn and picked up a gunny sack. I put the flour sack inside the gunny sack. This I rolled up and crammed lengthwise in the bib of my overalls. I was on my way. I was going after my dogs. Tahlequah was a small country town with a population of about 800. By the road, it was 32 miles away. But as the crow flies, it was only 20 miles. I went as the crow flies, straight through the hills. Although I had never been to town in my life, I knew what direction to take. Tahlequah and the railroad lay on the other side of the river from our place. I had the Frisco Railroad on my right and the Illinois River on my left. Not far from where the railroad crossed the river lay the town of Tahlequah. I knew if I bore to the right, I would find the railroad, and if I bore to the left, I had the river to guide me. Sometime that night, I crossed the river on a riffle somewhere in the Dripping Springs country. Coming out of the river bottoms, I scattered up a long hogback ridge and broke out on top in the flats. In a mile-eating trot, I moved along. I had the wind of a deer, the muscles of a country boy, a heart full of dog love, and a strong determination. I wasn't scared of the darkness or the mountains, for I was raised in those mountains. On and on, mile after mile, I moved along. I saw faint gray streaks appear in the east. I knew daylight was close. My bare feet were getting sore from the flint rocks and the saw briars. I stopped beside a mountain stream, soaked my feet in the cool water, rested for a spell, and then started on. After leaving the mountain stream, my pace was much slower. The muscles of my legs were getting stiff. Feeling the pangs of hunger gnawing at my stomach, I decided I would stop and eat at the next stream I found. Then I remembered I had forgotten to include a can in which to boil my eggs. I stopped and built a small fire. Cutting off a nice thick slab of salt pork, I roasted it, and with a piece of cold cornbread made a sandwich. Putting out my fire, I was on my way again. I ate as I trotted along. I felt much better. I came into Tahlequah from the northeast. At the outskirts of town, I hid my flour sack and provisions, keeping the gunny sack. I walked into town. I was scared of Tahlequah and the people. I had never seen such a big town and so many people. There was store after store, some of them two stories high. The wagon yard had wagons on top of wagons, teams, buggies, and horses. Two young ladies about my age stopped, stared at me, and then giggled. My blood boiled, but I could understand. After all, I had three sisters. They couldn't help it because they were woman folks. I went on. I saw a big man coming up the street. The bright, shiny star on his vest looked as big as a bucket. I saw the long black gun at his side, and I froze in my tracks. I'd heard of sheriffs and marshals, but had never seen one. Stories repeated about them in the mountains told how fast they were with a gun and how many men they had killed. The closer he came, the more frightened I got. I knew it was the end for me. I could just see him aiming his big black gun and shooting me between the eyes. It seemed like a miracle that he passed by, hardly glancing at me. Breathing a sigh, I walked on, seeing the wonders of the world. Passing a large store window, I stopped and stared. There in the window was the most wonderful sight I had ever seen. Everything under the sun. Overalls, jackets, bolts of beautiful cloth, new harnesses, collars, bridles. And then my eyes did pop open. There were several guns, and one of them had two barrels. I couldn't believe it. Two barrels. I'd seen several guns, but never one with two barrels. Then I saw something else. The sun was just right, and the plate glass was a perfect mirror. I saw the full reflection of myself for the first time in my life. I could see that I did look a little odd. My straw-colored hair was long and shaggy and was bushed out like a corn tassel that had been hit by a wind. I tried to smooth it down with my hands. This helped some, but not much. What it needed was a good combing, and I had no comb. My overalls were patched and faded, but they were clean. My shirt had pulled out. I tucked it back in. I took one look at my bare feet and winced. They were as brown as dead sycamore leaves. The spiderweb pattern of raw red scratches looked odd in the saddle-brown skin. I thought, well, I won't have to pick any more blackberries, and the scratches will soon go away. I pumped up one of my arms and thought surely the muscle was going to pop right through my thin blue shirt. I stuck out my tongue. It was as red as pokeberry juice, and anything that color was supposed to be healthy. After making a few faces at myself, I put my thumbs in my ears and was making mule ears when two old women came by. They stopped and stared at me. I stared back. As they turned to go on their way, I heard one of them say something to the other. The words were hard to catch, but I did hear one word, wild. As I said before, they couldn't help it. They were women folks. As I turned to leave, my eyes again fell on the overalls and the bolts of cloth. I thought of my mother, father, and sisters. Here was an opportunity to make amends for leaving home without telling anyone. I entered the store. I bought a pair of overalls for Papa. After telling the storekeeper how big my mother and sisters were, I bought several yards of cloth. I also bought a large sack of candy. Glancing down at my bare feet, the storekeeper said, "I have some good shoes." I told him I didn't need any shoes. He asked if that would be all. I nodded. He added up the bill. I handed him my $10. He gave me my change. After wrapping up the bundles, he helped me put them in my sack. Lifting it to my shoulder, I turned and left the store. Out on the street, I picked out a friendly-looking old man and asked him where the depot was. He told me to go down to the last street and turn right, go as far as I could, and I couldn't miss it. I thanked him and started on my way. Leaving the main part of town, I started up a long street through the residential section. I had never seen so many beautiful houses, and they were all different colors. The lawns were neat and clean and looked like green carpets. I saw a man pushing some kind of a mowing machine. I stopped to watch the whirling blades. He gawked at me. I hurried on. I heard a lot of shouting and laughing ahead of me. Not wanting to miss anything, I walked a little faster. I saw what was making the noise. More kids than I had ever seen were playing around a big red brick building. I thought some rich man lived there and was giving a party for his children. Walking up to the edge of the playground, I stopped to watch. The boys and girls were about my age and were as thick as flies around a sorghum mill. They were milling, running, and jumping. Teeter-totters and swings were loaded down with them. Everyone was laughing and having a big time. Over against the building, a large blue pipe ran up on an angle from the ground. A few feet from the top, there was a bend in it. The pipe seemed to go into the building. Boys were crawling into its dark mouth. I counted 9 of them. One boy stood about 6 feet from the opening with a stick in his hand. Staring goggle-eyed, trying to figure out what they were doing, I got a surprise. Out of the hollow pipe spurted a boy. He sailed through the air and lit on his feet. The boy with the stick marked the ground where he landed. All 9 of them came shooting out, one behind the other. As each boy landed, a new mark was scratched. They ganged around looking at the lines. There was a lot of loud talking, pointing, and arguing. Then all lines were erased, and a new scorekeeper was picked out. The others crawled back into the pipe. I figured out how the game was played. After climbing to the top of the slide, the boys turned around and sat down. One at a time, they came flying down and out, feet first. The one that shot out the furthest was the winner. I thought how wonderful it would be if I could slide down just one time. One boy, spying me standing on the corner, came over. Looking me up and down, he asked, "Do you go to school here?" I said, "School?" He said, "Sure, school. What'd you think it was?" "Oh, no, I don't go to school here." "You go to Jefferson?" "No, I don't go there either." "Don't you go to school at all?" "Sure, I go to school." "Where?" "At home." "You go to school at home?" I nodded. "What grade are you in?" I said I wasn't in any grade. Puzzled, he said, "You go to school at home and don't know what grade you're in? Who teaches you?" "My mother." "What does she teach you?" I said, "Reading, writing, and arithmetic, and I bet I'm just as good at it as you are." He asked, "Don't you have any shoes?" I said, "Sure I have shoes." "Why aren't you wearing them?" "Well, I don't wear shoes until it gets cold." He laughed and asked where I lived. I said, "Back in the hills." He said, "Oh, you're a hillbilly." He ran back to the mob. I saw him pointing at me and talking to several boys. They started my way, yelling, "Hillbilly, hillbilly." Just before they reached me, a bell started ringing. Turning, they ran to the front of the building, lined up in 2 long lines, and, marching like little tin soldiers, disappeared inside the school. The playground was silent. I was all alone and felt lonely and sad. I heard a noise on my right. I didn't have to turn around to recognize what it was. Someone was using a hoe. I'd know that sound if I heard it on a dark night. It was a little old white-headed woman working in a flower bed. Looking again at the long blue pipe, I thought, there's no one around. Maybe I can have one slide anyway. I eased over and looked up into the dark hollow. It looked scary, but I thought of all the other boys I had seen crawl into it. I could see the last mark on the ground and thought, I bet I can beat that. Laying my sack down, I started climbing up. The farther I went, the darker and more scary it got. Just as I reached the top, my feet slipped. Down I sailed. All the way down, I tried to grab onto something, but there was nothing to grab. I'm sure some great champions had slid out of that pipe, and no doubt more than one world record had been broken, but if someone had been there when I came out, I know the record I set would stand today in all its glory. I came out just like I went in, feet first and belly down. My legs were spread out like a bean shooter stalk. Arms flailing the air, I zoomed out and up. I seemed to hang suspended in air at the peak of my climb. I could see the hard-packed ground far below. As I started down, I shut my eyes tight and gritted my teeth. This didn't seem to help. With a splattering sound, I landed. I felt the air whoosh out between my teeth. I tried to scream, but had no wind left to make a sound. After bouncing a couple of times, I finally settled down to earth. I lay spread-eagled for a few seconds, and then slowly got to my knees. Hearing loud laughter, I looked around. It was a little old lady with a hoe in her hand. She hollered and asked how I liked it. Without answering, I grabbed up my gunny sack and left. Far up the street, I looked back. The little old lady was sitting down, rocking with laughter. I couldn't understand these town people. If they weren't staring at a fella, they were laughing at him. On arriving at the depot, my nerve failed me. I was afraid to go in. I didn't know what I was scared of, but I was scared. Before going around to the front, I peeked in a window. The station master was in his office looking at some papers. He was wearing a funny little cap that had no top in it. He looked friendly enough, but I still couldn't muster up enough courage to go in. I cocked my ear to see if I could hear puppies crying, but could hear nothing. A bird started chirping. It was a yellow canary in a cage. The station master walked over and gave it some water. I thought, anyone that is kind to birds surely wouldn't be mean to a boy. With my courage built up, I walked around to the front and eased myself past the office. He glanced at me and turned back to the papers. I walked clear around the depot and again walked slowly past the office. Glancing from the corner of my eye, I saw the station master looking at me and smiling. He opened the door and came out on the platform. I stopped and leaned against the building. Yawning and stretching his arms, he said,
"It sure is hot today. Doesn't look like it's ever going to rain."
I looked up at the sky and said, "Yes, sir, it is hot, and we sure could do with a good rain. We need one bad up where I come from." He asked me where I lived. I told him, "Up the river ways."
"You know," he said, "I have some puppies in there for a boy that lives up on the river. His name is Billy Coleman. I know his dad, but never have seen the boy. I figured he would be in after them today."
On hearing this remark, my heart jumped clear up in my throat. I thought surely it was going to hop right out on the depot platform. I looked up and tried to tell him who I was, but something went wrong. When the words finally came out, they sounded like the squeaky old pulley on our well when Mama drew up a bucket of water. I could see a twinkle in the station master's eyes. He came over and laid his hand on my shoulder. In a friendly voice, he said,
"So you're Billy Coleman. How is your dad?"
I told him Papa was fine and handed him the slip my grandpa had given me.
"They sure are fine-looking pups," he said. "You'll have to go around to the freight door."
I'm sure my feet never touched the ground as I flew around the building. He unlocked the door, and I stepped in looking for my dogs. I couldn't see anything but boxes, barrels, old trunks, and some rolls of barbed wire. The kindly station master walked over to one of the boxes.
"Do you want box and all?"
he asked. I told him I didn't want the box. All I wanted was the dogs.
"Well, how are you going to carry them?" he asked. "I think they're a little too young to follow."
I held out my gunny sack. He looked at me and looked at the sack. Chuckling, he said,
"Well, I guess dogs can be carried that way, same as anything else, but we'll have to cut a couple of holes to stick their heads through so that they won't smother."
Getting a claw hammer, he started tearing off the top of the box. As nails gave way and boards splintered, I heard several puppy whimpers. I didn't walk over, I just stood and waited. After what seemed like hours, the box was open. He reached in, lifted the pups out, and set them down on the floor.
"Well, there they are," he said. "What do you think of them?"
I didn't answer. I couldn't. All I could do was stare at them. They seemed to be blinded by the light and kept blinking their eyes. One sat down on his little rear and started crying. The other one was waddling around and whimpering. I wanted so much to step over and pick them up. Several times I tried to move my feet, but they seemed to be nailed to the floor. I knew the pups were mine, all mine, yet I couldn't move. My heart started acting like a drunk grasshopper. I tried to swallow and couldn't. My Adam's apple wouldn't work. One pup started my way. I held my breath. On he came until I felt a scratchy little foot on mine. The other pup followed. A warm puppy tongue caressed my sore foot. I heard the station master say, "They already know you." I knelt down and gathered them in my arms. I buried my face between their wriggling bodies and cried. The station master, sensing something more than just two dogs and a boy, waited in silence. Rising with the two pups held close to my chest, I asked if I owed anything. He said,
"There is a small feed bill, but I'll take care of it. It's not much anyway."
Taking his knife, he cut two slits in the sack. He put the pups in it and worked their heads through the holes. As he handed the sack to me, he said,
"Well, there you are. Goodbye, and good hunting."
Walking down the street toward town, I thought, now maybe the people won't stare at me when they see what I've got. After all, not every boy owns two good hounds. Turning the corner onto the main street, I threw out